From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on June 17th when Donald Trump announced he was running for president. The reality television star and real estate developer said he would be the only one telling the hard truths that Americans needed to hear. And then, on June 20th, Donald Trump said this.
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with us. They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people.
Trump's comments sparked widespread discussion and, in many cases, mockery. But it cannot be denied that after making those comments, Trump rose in the polls. He's now first or second in a number of state polls for the Republican primary. So what are the common misconceptions about immigration? And what's the reality? We're going to explore immigration in all of its complexity this hour. Let me introduce my guests for the hour. Hilda Chacon is here. She's an associate professor of Latin American Studies and Spanish at Nazareth College, a native of Costa Rica, she's got a very interesting broadcast background as well, and it's great to have you in studio. Thank you for being here, Hilda.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Tricia Cruz Irving is here. She's the Director of Development and Communications for the Ibero-American Action League. And you say Ibero, I say Ibero. Nice to have you, Tricia.
Thank you, and you can say either or.
Okay, very, very good. We don't discriminate. Pablo Sierra is here. He's an assistant professor of history at the University of Rochester. Pablo, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
We're talking about what has become kind of a cartoonish episode with Donald Trump, but I don't want to fixate for the entire conversation just on what it was that he said, though I will ask, and I'll start with you, Pablo. You have Mexican roots yourself. Are you offended by these kind of comments, or by now, where they're coming from, do you think, consider the source, you're not bothered? How do you feel about it?
They are deeply offending. I think you're absolutely right. They're cartoonish, right, in the sense that we have so many people of Mexican descent in this country, and to really label them as, you know, not the best people and then characterize them as rapists or drug traffickers is incredibly short-sighted, right? Especially for someone with such an important business background as Donald Trump has. As the story kind of grew, I wondered how someone like Carlos Slim, who is Mexico's richest man, would have approached, you know, this kind of sentiment from someone who's also very prominent in the business community. I think by this point, it's a plea for attention from a person who probably will not be a presidential contender. What worries me, I think, deep down is how much support this person has received, apparently, since these comments were made. That's deeply troubling to me. And I think it should trouble many people who are trying to push an image of a more inclusive American political system.
You make an interesting point there, because we've already heard from some of our listeners on social media today in preparation for this program who have said that his comments reflect the feelings of a certain segment of the population, and one of the reasons that he is now first or second mm-hmm. in many state polls and national polls are directly because of these comments.
Right. And that's really terrifying, right? We understand that we have two countries that are intertwined, that share an enormous land border, that also share a North American culture, right? That's deeply rooted in labor issues, but also in more common everyday things, in gastronomy, in music, in family, in fact, right? So I guess that's my concern. What kind of conversation do we need to have to convince people that most Mexican migrants are not criminals, are not felons? And what work are they doing in this country that's causing such polemic nowadays?
We'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. Hilda Chacon, your initial brief reaction to Mr. Trump's comments.
Well, I was also reflecting upon what Pablo just said, and I was thinking that, for example, in the state of New York, all the vegetables and the fruits that we can find in the stores have been picked up by migrant workers, documented or undocumented. That really doesn't matter, but it's thanks to the work that we can actually enjoy these items at an affordable price. So these people are probably never going to learn about these comments. Well, maybe they know about them. But it's a fact that we have those migrants in this country because the economy needs their work. We need them. And I don't think, of course, we all know, we all Latinos know that it's not fair to label us in such a pejorative way. And also, I think there are many countries within the United States. This is not a monolingual Anglo-Saxon country anymore.
Tricia Cruz Irving?
Well, you know, I do feel the need to say first that regardless of political affiliation, his comments are absolutely atrocious. What he says, every time that someone talks about immigrants or immigration, we're always talking about the Mexican community. But it's not just Mexicans who are coming to the United States. We have people who are coming here from Europe, from Asia, from the Middle East. But yet it's always Mexicans who are being described as, in his words, the murderers and the rapists. And it's disgusting because from someone who works with the Latino community and has met people in the Latino community, they are such hardworking people. And the most important thing to them is to provide for their family, to send their kids to school, that they graduate, that they get a good job. My parents in particular, I think about them and how hard they've worked. And so to hear these kind of words and to then to know that other people feel the same way that he does, that is really scary because I personally don't think he's going to win. But let's just say that he does. That's really terrifying to think that somebody with those thoughts would be in that position of power.
Have you talked to people in our community who have already responded? I mean, are Donald Trump's comments, are they hurting people? Are people talking about them?
You know, I'll be honest. I, for the most part, try not to engage in political conversations.
Yeah.
And because those can get very heated when you have different views, regardless of who the people are. I know I've seen some postings on social media where I think one day Trump said that he will get the Latino vote. And somebody in the Latino community, very influential, had said, "You will not get my people's vote." You know, to hear statements like that, it's just, it's dumb to say the least. And I say that word, you know, because I'm trying to be diplomatic. But, you know, it doesn't make people feel good. It doesn't make people feel proud. It's hurtful. I mean, to hear those kinds of words and for somebody to be categorizing all Mexicans as murderers and rapists, that's just ridiculous.
Well, let's talk about who, and I hesitate to overgeneralize, and I don't want to overgeneralize, but let's try to have a substantive discussion, if we could, about the various kinds of people who do come across the border and the various reasons, because it's not just somebody who is a rapist or somebody who is a violent felon, obviously. But there are a number of comments and questions that I want to refer to that will help kind of lead some of this. You know, for example, Donald Trump made his remarks, and writing for Politico, Rich Lowry, who is also National Review's editor, wrote a piece called "Sorry, Donald Trump Has a Point." And here's what Rich Lowry wrote. Quote, "As for his instantly notorious Mexico comments, they did more to insult than to illuminate, yet there was a kernel in them that hit on an important truth that typical politicians either don't know or simply fear to speak. When Mexico sends its people, Trump said, they're not sending their best. This is obviously correct. We aren't raiding the top 1% of Mexicans and importing them to this country. Instead, we are getting representative Mexicans who, through no fault of their own, of course, come from a poorly educated country at a time when education is essential to success in an advanced economy." Rich Lowry, poorly educated country. Pablo Sierra, some thoughts on that?
Man, I think that's a very difficult comment. I think we really have to understand where immigration has been coming from since 1994. And I choose 1994 because that's when the North American Free Trade Agreement was enacted. And what we have is supposedly an economic program that was going to unite Canada, the United States, and Mexico into one economic bloc. What we've actually had is a program that has resulted in the importation of mass amounts of American corn to Mexico. And the direct effect has been that Mexican agriculturalists cannot compete with that corn. They can't compete with that corn because that corn is subsidized by the U.S. government. In other words, in constructing this free trade bloc, we forgot about the most important staple for the Mexican population, for the Mexican diet. And the communities that are producing the largest number of migrants are precisely those corn-dependent communities. So who are we receiving? We're receiving a lot of people that would have had their own farms, that would have had their own corn milpas, and now they don't, right? So in that sense, yes, we are pulling from the rural sector of the country, but we're also bringing in people from the cities, people who do have education, people who are, to be quite honest, very tired of corruption, of the way that employment actually occurs in Mexico, and they are themselves looking for a chance, and they're willing to do anything. In Philadelphia, specifically New York, that New Jersey corridor, many, many of those people staff the entire restaurant industry, right? So they're often far more qualified than their restaurant jobs would seem to imply. We have a huge cross-section of Mexican society, and it's not just the worst.
Hilda Chacon, you want to weigh in?
Yes. If I may add to that, I also wanted to say that it's a mistake to think about Mexico as a country of uneducated people and as a poor country. Mexico is not a poor country. In fact, Carlos Slim has been the richest man, not on Mexico, but on the planet, along with Bill Gates, for the last few years. So that speaks about a country that has resources and has a strong economy. Mexico also has very old and sophisticated universities and research centers, and we cannot assume that everybody in Mexico is uneducated. What I think is something that many Americans do not know is that resources are very unequally distributed in
yes.
Mexico. So then you have like different countries coexisting in the same territory. Therefore, you have migrants who come from very poor background, and you have very wealthy and highly educated persons who come to this country. So there's a lot of multiplicity in Mexico, and we cannot just simplify such a complex and rich country in such a poor way.
Tricia Cruz Irving, what is the risk in taking the kind of writing that Rich Lowry has here, saying that who are we getting from Mexico? Well, the uneducated people. Hey, it's not their fault, but we're getting the uneducated people, and Trump was kind of right. What is the concern that you have in overgeneralizing about a population of people who want to be in this country?
You know, a couple of things come to mind. For example, when they say, quote unquote, the uneducated people, well, one thing that I hear from a lot of businesses and organizations and other individuals is that some of these people who are coming here are doing jobs that Americans don't want to do. And if you don't have migrant workers here, who's going to be doing that job? Now, that's not to say that I'm saying it's okay to come here illegally, not at all, because I'll give you my mother as a perfect example. She's from Santiago, Chile, and she moved to the U.S. in 1969. She did everything above board according to law, and now she's a U.S. citizen. She came here, and she didn't go to college in Chile, and she left because it happened shortly before the Pinochet took over, and she left, and she worked at a factory here. But she worked really, really hard. She and my father, who's from Puerto Rico, worked really, really hard for almost 45 years. And now 45 years later, they have three houses, and they're enjoying the fruits of their labor. So my mom didn't go to college, but look at where she is now. She's done really well for herself, as has my father. So when you get people here from other countries, maybe they don't have a college degree. Maybe they don't have a master's. But that doesn't mean that we should be discriminating against them because they don't come from a rich family. And on that note, I will say is I've lived in Santiago, Chile, and I've been going there since I was little, and I've been going to Puerto Rico as well, my whole life to both. And I will say that you have not seen poor until you go to one of these countries or islands. When you are there, you see people living in shacks. You see their living conditions are like nothing that you see here. So they're looking for a better life. And it's understandable that they get to that point where they're desperate to get out of said country so that they can hopefully make a better life for themselves. But again, with that said, I'm not saying that it's okay to come here illegally, but I can understand what would drive them to want to leave the country they're in.
Okay, and so I think what we're hearing is that kind of a perspective, while also, as Hilda and Pablo are saying, those aren't the only people coming across. There's certainly people who are coming in various forms in various sectors of the Mexican economy and the Mexican class, for example. But I also want to visit a point about drugs. Donald Trump talked a lot about drugs as an issue. And we had a comment from a listener named Mark who says, this whole episode with El Chapo should be evidence that Mexico is not serious about drugs and that we should take that very seriously. I think Mark is referring to, as I understand it, the most notorious drug kingpin in Mexico. His nickname is El Chapo. Mm-hmm. He escaped prison for the second time. I think he has escaped a good number of years ago. Mm-hmm. He was captured last year. He was in a maximum security prison and went out through the shower into a tunnel and is gone, I guess. Mm-hmm. And Mark is saying, well, this is evidence that Mexico is not serious about drugs and that we should be very concerned about that and very concerned about its people. I don't know how you ascribe to Mexican people the actions of a drug kingpin who escaped prison, but I'll start with Pablo. What do you make of Mark's comments?
I think Mexico's incredibly serious about the drug problem. I think we've had, well over 50,000 deaths as a result of a drug war mm-hmm. that has been waged specifically, mm-hmm. At first in northern Mexico and now has spread, unfortunately, to much of the country. We're paying for a drug habit that's international, that's cosmopolitan. We're paying with the lives of 20-year-olds, 15-year-olds, 18-year-olds. We're very serious about this problem. What I would say to Mark is, Mark, why is it that people like El Chapo have been able to make so much money? Where is this money coming from if Mexico is supposedly such a poor nation? There is huge demand for drugs. Mm-hmm.
And can I ask what seems like a logical follow-up on this, Pablo, which is that, again, going back to the comments that started this with Donald Trump saying who's coming across the people, they're bringing drugs, they're in the drug trade, they're rapists. If you wanted to work in the drug trade, you could do it in Mexico. You don't have to come here to do it.
Right,
is that
exactly.
incorrect?
No, that's absolutely correct. And it's something that we're struggling with on an everyday basis. And it's something that is taxing Mexican small business owners that have to pay rent to these cartels for protection, for not having their businesses raided. Look, the work that Mexicans, and specifically the Mexican government, really has to tackle is a reform of the judicial system, of how crimes are processed, of who gets sent to jail, of who doesn't get sent to jail. And of course, we need to keep these high-profile criminals locked up. El Chapo is evidence that we are dealing with something much larger than your average little drug trafficker. He has an international network at his disposal. And clearly, the kind of money he has is proof that the Mexican judicial system is very corrupt and can be corrupted as long as that money keeps coming in.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anybody doubts that this situation is a disaster. But again, to ascribe then this to a population of people coming across the border is strange. Hilda Chacon.
Yes, I also wanted to mention that it's very interesting to me that any time that we talk about narco-trafficking in the United States, it seems like we as a country have been victimized by those evildoers on the other side of the border. Like if we had nothing to do, like if we were not the largest market for those drugs in the planet, we are. And the only way that drugs make it into this country is not in the little mochilas of the migrant workers who cross the border on foot. They come in large ships. They come in large airplanes. Somebody is looking the other side when those humongous shipments enter into this country, and we don't talk about that.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about immigration, who is coming into this country, particularly over our southern border. And yes, the impetus was some of the comments that have propelled Donald Trump into a more competitive position in the early polling for Republican primary states. I'm sure you've heard the comments that he made about Mexicans. And let me go ahead and read them again, just because it's been a few minutes. We heard them at the top of the hour. Let's read them. And then what I want to do is follow up on the question of the drug war itself, because we could probably do an hour or a week or a month on whether the drug war has succeeded at all or if it has simply perpetuated sort of a criminal underclass in this country and others. And I do want to hit that point in a moment. But here's what Donald Trump initially said that had so many people fired up. He said, quote, "When do we beat Mexico at the border? They're laughing at us, at our stupidity. And now they are beating us economically. They are not our friend, believe me, but they're killing us economically. The U.S. has become a dumping ground for everybody else's problems. It's true, and these are the best and the finest. When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're not sending you. They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with them. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people." That little qualification at the end. Tricia, that last line, did that save the comments for you at all? No. I don't mean to be flippant. I mean, that last little remark is so absurd.
A resounding no.
Yeah.
Because he's really just generalizing. And again, you know, all the Mexicans that I know here in Rochester, Monroe County, all the Latinos that I know are such hardworking people. And so to make those remarks, I would just hope and think that people in at least Rochester, Monroe County are smart enough to know better than to think the same along the same lines as him.
Now, on the question of drugs, though, do we look at this and instead of saying, well, hey, some bring drugs across the border, therefore, you know, we know drugs are evil and Mexicans must be evil. Is there enough evidence now to look at the drug war and ask real questions about whether it is a failure, whether it should continue at all, and what it has done?
What do you mean by evidence?
Well, I mean the fact of the population of incarcerated people, the population of incarcerated people who are only drug offenders who have only possessed drugs, people who end up pulled into, I think, a drug trade that becomes very violent potentially. You know, what do we think right now, Hilda?
If we want to put an end to the drug trafficking war, we have to stop consuming drugs, period.
Yeah, that's ambitious. I don't know that that's gonna ever stop. But I think there is a public consensus, at least among Latin Americans, and now prominent Latin Americans, ex-presidents, Fernando Henrique Cardoso, the president of Brazil, who have said, you know what, it hasn't worked. It really hasn't worked for our region. Let's stop attacking the drug trade and get at the root problems of drug consumption. In Mexico, there's been somewhat of a liberalization in this that, for instance, small quantities of marijuana, you can now possess them in Mexico City. And that has helped, of course, reduce a prison population that is, of course, victimized for drug use. We have to focus on these very, very larger-than-life figures like El Chapo. But we also have to understand that these are international corporations. We don't like talking about cartels from the financial aspect. But when we understand that these are people who are running really international companies that have extremely sophisticated distribution networks, well, then the best way to hit them is to get their money. Let's get their bank accounts. Let's seize their properties. Let's not just raid a random plantation, burn it down, and have a photo op for it. That does nothing. Let's have some real cooperation in terms of information, banks, and let's take the money away from these people who, in the end, are in it for the money.
All right. So part of what I'm hearing, when you talk about raiding a random plantation, burning it down,
right.
And yes, that makes for big, colorful photos, and it makes everyone feel like, look at this victory in the war on drugs. Mm-hmm. The person who maybe was growing, and I'm not condoning growing. I hope nobody hears this program and thanks to anybody on this program. I mean, you just heard Hilda say, if we stop doing drugs, amazing what that would do. It's ambitious. It is true what Hilda's saying. But when they burn a plantation down, okay, a poor farmer may be hurt by that. The people who end up in prison are generally not El Chapo, and if the El Chapos find their way out. The people who benefit from this are the El Chapos. They make a lot of money, and they hold a lot of power. And the people who are hurting, it looks like, are generally on the lower socioeconomics, but they're kind of pulled into the maelstrom of this. Hilda Chacon?
I was just thinking that Milton Friedman, for example, one of the Chicago Boys, was in favor of legalizing the production and consumption of drugs because of financial reasons, because that would be the only legal way to access their accounts and make them pay taxes and also regulate the quality of the product. I'm not saying that I'm for that, But from a financial point of view, it's a very interesting proposal.
Sure. But let's be honest here. We can huff gasoline if we want to. There are lots of ways to get high that you can do technically legally. And one of the most interesting developments I've seen in this state since 2003, 146 drug courts now. And some of the most conservative judges I know in upstate New York, in rural areas, have said, I was tired of seeing the same faces. Incarcerated, they come out, back in, and eventually you have to treat the problem. So even some very conservative judges I know said, we're establishing a drug court because we want to treat the person, treat it as a medical problem. Obviously, you don't condone if there is violence or theft of property, those kind of things that are attached to it. Those are crimes. But for people who are addicted to drugs, I've seen a fascinating shift with New York drug courts with very interesting results, a drop in recidivism. And it says to me that if we care about the actual person and them getting clean, for example, as Hilda said, not doing drugs anymore, then maybe you approach it in a different way. And so at least we're seeing that. But whether that ever starts to have a broader ripple nationally, internationally, I don't know. I don't know how much government equity there is behind this kind of war. Is there a risk to admitting that it was perhaps a failure and doing it a different way?
You know, I do want to answer something you said, you know, so in regards to, do we think that we're better off now compared to previous years on the drug war? And to answer that question, I personally would have to take a look at the numbers. But Pablo brought up a really good point about 10 minutes ago when he said El Chapo's of the world and others wouldn't be doing so well if the demand wasn't there. Mm-hmm. And granted, it's not always a lot of poor people are somehow finding money to buy drugs, but you know, a lot of wealthy people do as well. And one thing that comes to mind as we've been talking here is, for example, you know, we talk about corruption in Mexico. Donald Trump made his comments about most of the people coming here are involved in drugs or, you know, problematic. Several months ago or last year, several DEA agents were caught being in cahoots with cartels. I think it was in, I forget which country it was in. And they're supposed to be the ones who are supposed to be the law enforcement. And instead, they were taking money and having parties or whatnot in hotel rooms that belonged to these cartels. And as far as I know, they were Caucasian. But I don't hear Donald Trump saying anything about them. Instead, he's just pointing to the Mexicans who are coming here to work hard. And granted, some of them, yes, they're criminals, and you know, but not all of them are.
That is the other side of the story that I was referring to.
Let's get a short break, and we're going to come right back and talk about misconceptions about crime statistics. What are your common ideas about the level of crime committed by immigrants in this country? We address that next. Coming up in our second hour, it's a new edition of How Do You Do That? We've enlisted the help of local experts to answer a number of questions, from how do you fill an inner loop? How do you know you've stayed too long at your favorite coffee shop? How do you dress for air travel? How do you learn the rules of the road if you want to ride your bicycle to work? And how do you really make a New York-style pizza? All of those questions and more answered next hour. Welcome back to Connections. My guests include Tricia Cruz Irving from Ibero-American Action League, Hilda Chacon, a professor of Latin American Studies at Nazareth College, and Pablo Sierra, a professor of history at the University of Rochester. And I know Pablo wanted to make a point about crime because there's become this common idea that immigrants commit higher levels of crime.
Yeah, I'd like to highlight a recent study that was just published by the American Immigration Council. This is the July 2015 report. And they have hard evidence, hard data on how many crimes immigrants commit compared to the native-born population. And it's online. It's available to anyone. It's really informative, right? We have this stunning number. It says that 1.6% of immigrant males aged 18 to 39 are incarcerated. 1.6%, Evan, that is not a large number. When we look at the native-born population, that number rises to 3.3%. So in other words, immigrants are two times less likely to commit crimes than native-born people in this country. these are the kind of studies that we really need to circulate, that we really need to get out there to have informed debates about what immigrants do and what they don't do.
So when you hear a presidential candidate talk about Mexicans in a way that says they're rapists, they're bringing drugs, they're committing crimes, you can point to the numbers and say immigrants to this country commit fewer crimes than people who were born into this country. Yes?
Yes, absolutely. Many, by a factor of what, 2, 3, 4? And again, these are nonpartisan research institutes.
But maybe Donald Trump would say, but what about illegal immigrants? What about people?
Right, right. And if we, what we need to understand is that undocumented migrants have even less of an incentive to break laws, mm-hmm. right? An undocumented person is especially cautious because his or her position in American society is that more precarious, right? So, of course, if you don't have documents, you're not going to run a red light. If you don't have documents, you're not going to have a drug deal, right, outside of a, you know, convenience store. You're not going to have that behavior because there's nothing to protect you from deportation, mm-hmm. right? So we need to think of this logically. Why would an undocumented immigrant have this kind of behavior? Well, 98.4 of them don't, right? So let's get informed. Let's get the facts out.
But you know what happens, yeah. and we both know from working in the media, is that, let's say, there's one person who happens to be from Mexico who's committed a crime, and he or she happens.
Absolutely.
That's what the media covers.
Yeah, absolutely right, Tricia. And then, if you want to sort of wade into the most toxic places in this country, go to the comment sections in various online sites, and people will say things like, just another undocumented person who shouldn't have been here. This person, the stores wouldn't have been robbed. This person may still be alive. And then all of a sudden, all people from Mexico get that tag.
Exactly, because the media is not covering stories about the hard workers who are here or the people who have come here legally and followed the rules. They're covering the stories that they know are going to rile people up.
And that, by the way, is a broader comment about the media in general. And again, I have a lot of respect for my former colleagues at various television stations, and I know they work hard. But look at nightly newscasts, and you will often see, and not even about immigrants or illegal immigrants, you'll see crime stories in Rochester, as if every city street corner has a murder every day. And if you don't get any statistical context for it, and you watched the news every day, you might think our city is going down in flames. So I think in general, we don't do a very good job contextualizing anyway. But then you get one high-profile story of a quote-unquote illegal immigrant murder or whatever you want to categorize it, and that spreads. I do agree with that. I think that's an important point. Hilda?
But I think sometimes the media portray a different kind of an image on immigrants, like this program that you are leading right now. What concerns me is that now we have the internet. So data like the one that Pablo is sharing with us is available for everyone to see. So I think the consumers of culture and information nowadays do not depend so heavily on the media because they can have direct access to the internet. But in spite of that access, still, the vision of that other person who lives on the other side of the border as a mean person, as a destructive person, as a disease for this society prevails. And I think that is where also we need to focus our attention. Why do these negative perceptions about others who live over there prevail in spite of all the information that we have available nowadays?
What's the answer? What do you think, Hilda?
I don't have an answer, but I think it's a very valid question.
Oh, I do too. I think we have to sort of look inward for some of those answers, and we might not always like what we find, but I think that's an important part of the steps here. Mm-hmm. We're talking to a panel from various parts of our community about immigration, myths, facts, and more. Pablo Sierra, professor of history at the University of Rochester. Hilda Chacon, associate professor of Latin American Studies at Nazareth College. Tricia Cruz Irving, the director of development and communications for the Ibero-American Action League in Rochester. And I want to get a couple more listener questions and comments in. Perry writes to us, Thanks for having this program. I confess I'm ignorant about this topic. What is the most common misconception people have about immigration? It's a good question, and I'm wondering, in general, are rates of immigration up or down, and do we get that wrong in general?
Yeah, I think that's probably the most important number right now. Unauthorized immigration to the U.S. has been declining since 2007. It's directly tied to how the American economy functions. It has nothing to do with border enforcement or putting more military resources at the border. It has nothing to do with
that. So when the market struggles...
When the market struggles, migrants don't want to be in that market.
Yeah.
Right? And so a prominent sociologist, Douglas Massey, has argued time and time again, let's stop investing money in securing the border, right? This phrase that you're going to hear incessantly for the next year. Understand that militarizing the border retains an undocumented population that previously would return home. We think that in the 80s and 90s, about 85% of migrants went back home. They worked in the States for a couple months, made a few dollars, and went home to invest those earnings. That can't happen anymore when you secure the border, right? So we need to understand that things have changed since the economic recession, right? And we need to come to terms with the fact that illegal immigration is not the problem that it was 10, 15 years ago.
Hilda Chacon?
And, thank you. I'm also thinking that Puerto Rican intellectual Juan Gonzalez argues that the huge migration of Latinos into the United States is intimately linked to the U.S. economic policies toward Latin America that have created a dependency to this economy and has somehow disappeared local economies, and that has created humongous migrations into the main center of production that continues being the United States.
So how would our other panelists answer Perry's question on what the biggest misconceptions are? Tricia?
You know, I'd have to say, first and foremost, I really appreciate that question because he comes forward and admits that he's not really aware of it and then comes out and asks, you know, what is the biggest misconception? So that's somebody who's coming out and asking because he wants to learn. So it'd be awesome to have more people asking those kinds of questions. To be honest, one of the biggest misconceptions is just what we've been talking about, that most people who come here are from Mexico, that they're criminals. Because, again, that's not the case. I think that's the biggest misconception, and I think that really hurts the entire community, and not just the Latino community, but everybody, because it makes one side feel scared or ignorant of what the truth is, and then it makes the other side feel offended, regardless of whether you're Mexican or not, but even just in the Latino community, because, you know, people are just generalizing.
Hilda?
Another common misconception is that we are all exactly the same. There are humongous differences among Latin Americans, people who come from Latin America, even though we speak the same language. So that's another misconception, very common.
I think well said. Paul writes to the program, can you ask about the impact of deportation, the actual impact, what actually happens to families when deportation happens?
Go ahead.
I mean, deportation is really the act of rooting someone outside of a society that they've already invested in, right? If we follow the case of someone who has spent maybe 2-3 years here, who has maybe a child, maybe a wife, and for some reason or another is deported, then you have eliminated one of the breadwinners of that family from that unit, and all of a sudden, what's going to happen to those people that remain in this country? Well, of course, they're going to need some kind of assistance, maybe more social services than they did previously. And so it's a really counterintuitive kind of policy to espouse. We're at record levels for deportations. We've never seen this many deportations. Mm-hmm. What, fiscal year 2013, we hit 400,000 people.
And again,
deported.
When you talk about misconceptions, this current administration would be characterized as being soft on deportation, and, you know, however you want to characterize it, that would be the caricature, wouldn't it?
Yes, it's been, I mean, to be quite honest, this current administration has been terrible in terms of the number of people that have been deported. And not just that, because it's 2 million people that have been deported over the past several years. The effect of those deportations on families in the States and throughout Latin America. How do we quantify that? We can't. But we know that it's a destructive strategy. There has to be a better way. Deportation answers very, very little.
I agree with Pablo. That's one of the areas in which this government has, I think, failed. A very progressive government, but then the deportation policy continues to be tremendously increasing throughout the years. And I have to mention the human component of this experience, because my students have worked with migrant families in the area through a service learning project. And for them, seeing from an up-close and personal perspective, families that get destroyed because the father or the mother gets deported because they didn't have their papers in order, while they were just working 24/7 in very harsh works in the fields, that I'm not sure that any one of us could put up with that kind of a demanding work. And that, what's their crime? Mainly, I think, being poor.
Shelby writes to the program and wants to know if the panel thinks there is an actual illegal immigration problem. And again, that comes from a comment that I received this morning from someone online who was somewhat defensive of Mr. Trump's remarks and was saying that the extreme opposite are people who don't even acknowledge that there's at least a problem. So I'll ask the panel. I'll go around, start with Tricia. Shelby wants to know, is there an illegal immigration problem in this country?
You know, the best way that I can answer that is that based on the last figure that I've heard, that there are 12 million illegal immigrants in the U.S. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that's the last figure, roughly 12 million people. That's a lot. And I would say yes. And this is a really, really tough question to answer because on the one hand, yes, you have people here who are just working really hard to provide for their families. So is deportation the answer or not? And I have to be honest, for this, I really have to go back to my mom's experience because she came here from Santiago, Chile in 1969, and she followed all the rules. So I can understand it, but I don't support illegal immigration because my mom's my biggest example, because she came here legally and did it the correct way. I can understand, again, why people would want to come
here.
Why
people do it.
Yes, I can completely understand that, but we have laws for a reason, and those laws have to be followed. I'm not saying the answer is to just all of a sudden deport everybody who's been here, because at the same time, if they've been here for so long and companies have been employing them knowing that they were here illegally, well, the company's at fault too then. So it shouldn't just be the family or that person that's penalized too, because if there's been somebody who's been paying them, well, they're responsible as well for having kept them here. So that's just a really tough question to answer. And I don't have the solution or know what the solution would be to really address that situation.
Okay. Hilda Checklin?
If we're going to be concerned about undocumented immigrants, maybe we should go back in history and think on the pilgrims who arrived to this country with no paper and took over the territories from the original inhabitants of the territories. This country has been built by migrants since the very beginning. Migrants from all over the place that pursued the American dream. And I don't see why these 12 million people don't have the right to search for the same dream. The important question should be, what are these 12 million people doing right now? Are they contributing to the society in any way, or they are not? So in that case, some of them may deserve to apply for documentation. Some of them may not. But we cannot think on these numbers just in abstract. We would need further research on what they are doing and contributing with to this country.
Right. I think we do have a problem with unauthorized immigrants in this country. We live in a country of 320 million people. Okay, 11 or 12 million of them don't have documents. That's not an insignificant portion of the population. There are ways to get at this. Most migrants don't want to be undocumented. Most migrants would rather have paperwork. So a very simple solution to a problem like this is let's issue more temporary work visas. Congress has actually been doing this for quite some time. We never talk about legal migration to the United States. Congress has actually been authorizing higher and higher numbers of temporary migrants who have full rights. Let's talk about that. How else do we fix this issue? We incentivize people to stay in their home communities. If we stop exporting, I don't know, how many millions of dollars are given for fighting the drug trade and arming the Mexican army, let's invest those millions in agricultural techniques. Let's keep people at home before they become a problem, before they have to cross a border, before they have to separate from their families. There are many ways to fix this. We just have to start looking at this problem from a different vantage point.
Okay, I've got a few minutes left with our panel here, and we've tried to cover a lot of ground, and I certainly appreciate their perspective here while answering as many of your questions as we can. But I want to go around the table and just ask, as we go forward now, certainly the heat and the rhetoric of a presidential campaign makes things sometimes a little silly. Pablo mentioned that, yes, we're going to hear a lot about securing the border. And I don't mean to mock those who are concerned about that. Again, I think those are people who may have good intentions or are concerned about undocumented immigration. But what's been missing from this conversation? What do you want to leave our listeners with, especially as we hear we have more conversations, more dialogue about immigration and what happens next, Pablo?
I think we have an incredibly diverse country. I don't think it's ever been this diverse. That's something to be proud of, right? That's something remarkable. Not every country has the kind of linguistic richness, cultural richness that this country has, right? Let's embrace it. Let's not shy away from it. Let's not pretend that people don't eat at Chipotle. People love Chipotle, you know? And that's okay. That's a good thing. It's good for Jeb Bush to openly say, I'm married to a Mexican woman and my kids are bilingual. That's a good thing, right? So let's embrace this new United States, this new America that we live in, and take each one of these issues piecemeal. Let's try.
It is fascinating that some people would seek to penalize Jeb Bush, I mean penalize politically, for having bilingual children as if it's a threat to the English language in this country. But I've heard it.
Yeah.
It's Hilda Chacon.
What's missing? I would ask people who are listening to this program to find out where their vegetables and fruits come from, and maybe they can visit the farms and see the conditions under which the workers live and ask themselves if they would do that same work for the same payment. That might give the listeners a different perspective on immigration.
Tricia Cruz Irving?
I would hope that listeners would walk away with knowing that here locally, we have a very hardworking Latino community with people from various countries, but who work really hard, who focus on their family, on educating their children, who want to give back to the community, who are happy to be here, proud to be here, and really just truly want to make a better life for themselves. And that what's happening at the national level isn't necessarily the case here.
Two of our three guests are professors, but Tricia Cruz Irving is the Director of Development and Communications for the Ibero-American Action League in Rochester, which does what? For our listeners, remind our listeners what it is that Ibero does.
We are a dual-language human services agency, and we help lead people to self-sufficiency, and we focus on the entire family unit, preparing children for school, helping high school students do well in school, and then preparing individuals for the workforce.
And helping how many people on an annual basis?
More than 10,000.
More than 10,000.
And we now offer business services, too, to help people market the Latino community.
And they can get in touch with you how?
On our website, www.iaal.org, that's iaal.org, or give me a call at 256-8900.
It's been great talking to you, as always. I always enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
Of course.
Tricia Cruz Irving from Ibero. Hilda Chacon is an associate professor of Latin American Studies, among other things, at Nazareth College. It's been great having you. And before I let you go, please tell me a little bit more about your daughter and StoryCorps, because that's so popular with our listeners. Can we do that a little bit?
Yes, of course, if you want. My daughter, Nadia Raymond, she is the second in command at StoryCorps. She's a senior producer, and she loves doing her job. She's in charge right now of the initiative called Out Loud that is targeting the LGBT community. So if you happen to hear that StoryCorps is coming to your town with their itinerary recording booth, sign up for a conversation and be part of this wonderful program.
And congratulations to her on that, and thank you for being here. Pablo Sierra is a professor of history at the University of Rochester, and Pablo first was on this program. Pablo and his wife Molly are the reasons that every month on Education Friday we do a segment called the College Class You Wish You Could Have Taken. Because Pablo and Molly, there was the first when the World Cup, the men's World Cup came to Brazil last year. I said, I don't know much about Brazil. And someone said, did you know that the University of Rochester has a class called History of Latin America Through Soccer? I hope that was a fun class to teach.
Very fun. Very, very
that
fun.
That is a wonderful idea. And I always appreciate your perspective. It's great having you. Thank you, Pablo.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Member-Supported Public Radio. I'm Evan Dawson.